Hi, and welcome to Voices in the Wilderness, a show on science and faith that addresses questions posed by skeptics, Christians and non-Christians, people who are struggling to reconcile science and faith or see just how those two realms can live together, and those who are deconstructing and reconstructing. We bring various voices and conversations to open paths for people to walk along with Jesus on their journey. If you are watching live on Facebook or YouTube, please drop us a note in the chat boxes and we'll try to keep an eye out for them and bring up your comments or your questions. So today, I'm really excited. Today we have Janet Kellogg-Ray, who is currently an adjunct professor at the University of North Texas in the Department of Biological Sciences. She holds a PhD in curriculum and instruction from the University of North Texas, a master's in education and gifted education from Harding Simmons University, and a bachelor's in science education in biology from Abilene Christian University. She's an enthusiastic science educator who blogs at janetkray.com on the intersection of science, faith, and culture. Raised a young earth creationist, she is uniquely equipped to explain evolution to questioners, doubters, deniers, and those who just want to know more about the science of origins. She's been there and she understands. Welcome, Janet. It's so great to have you with us again.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be back with you guys.
Yeah, I just finished reading your study guide that goes with your book, Baby Dinosaurs in the Park, and I think that's going to be kind of the main topic of our conversation today. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself for our listeners?
Well, I was practically born in church. I was born on a Sunday afternoon, and because the doctor told my mom that to expect a long labor, my dad just went on to Sunday morning worship services and just dropped back in time for the birth. And so after that, we were in church three times a week, Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. The church, the tradition in which I was raised was a very Bible literalist in general tradition. The Churches of Christ is the tradition that I was raised in. And honestly, I didn't hear a lot of anti-evolution or anti-science messages from my church because young earth creationism was just simply the default. And so we would have no more questioned the literal interpretation of Genesis than we would have questioned the existence of Jesus. And so it wasn't until I studied life sciences and biology in middle school, high school, that I remember thinking, ooh, this something is not coming together, but I didn't have the vocabulary to even express that disconnect that I was feeling. It was I remember kind of trying to do some mental gymnastics of if I can just look at the fossil record with maybe one eye closed, I can make it fit the Genesis account. And so, you know, I went on to an undergraduate degree in biology, and then with my master's and my PhD, I always had science education there. And, you know, I as a young adult, you know, I started studying and reading on my own and just, you know, found that I could no longer live with the intellectual dishonesty of trying to force a literal Genesis and make it fit with science.
I wanted to say thank you for joining us again, Janet. We are live on Facebook and YouTube. And as Christine said, if you all want to make a comment or ask a question, feel free to do so. And she's got a very quick trigger finger, and I'm a Kindle guy, so I don't normally get to do this, but I'm going to beat Christine to the trigger and wave my copy of a study guide for baby dinosaurs right now, because I know she's got two copies there herself. So I finally beat you. So very similar background to a lot of people that we talk to, Janet, and we do have our earlier interview with you where you kind of went into more detail on that and also in your first book. But as an educator, do you run into a lot of people who are on the path of deconstruction over the church's treatment of science and so forth?
Well, you know, I told the story in the first book of, and since that story happened, there have been other stories like that where I've had students pushed back against me, and they never do it until the very end of the semester saying, I don't believe what you're saying. I believe God. But on the other hand, I've also had two other stories from the opposite end of the spectrum. I had a biology major's course one time in which there was a student sitting on the front row, and I just noticed in his stack of textbooks that he had with him, he had Francis Collins' Language of God sitting on the top of his stack of books. And so I asked him about it, and he too had come from a literalist, more of a fundamentalist evangelical background, but had come across Collins' book. And so that became a great conversation between the two of us. And I just happened to see his book there on his stack of books. And then I had another student, again, a biology major, and I'm trying to recall how that conversation began, but that conversation started several other, you know, meeting for coffee, meeting for tea afterwards, because this young man was actually raised in a communist country as an atheist. And he goes, I wasn't just raised that there was no God. He said, I was raised that religion was bad and the source of the evil in the world. And so after moving to the United States, he became a Christian, but he became a Christian in a young earth creationist tradition. And so we had lots of conversations after that. It was like the relief on his face and his body posture as a new Christian coming out of a very antagonistic environment toward religion, being told by someone, no, it's okay, you can believe science. And he just said, I mean, he literally just like, oh, well, that is such a relief to me. And so it's interesting to have those two students on there, not really a path of deconstruction, but more of a path of trying to make it all fit as a young adult in university.
Yeah, that's interesting. I remember one of my kids in her first college biology class coming up to me about halfway through the semester going, Mom, I knew we were going to talk about evolution in this class, but I had no idea that biology, like, it's all evolution. That's what it is. Biology mm-hmm. and evolution. Mm-hmm. Those are synonyms. Those are the same thing. It's all. I just didn't know that. So I was glad as a mom that we had talked through these issues before she went off, and she did
that's
have
one thing. And you know, that's one thing I try to do in my classes, because I have no idea what anyone's background is, and so I save the deep dive to evolution, the nuts and bolts and all the background, the history. Honestly, I'm starting it this week. I save it to the end of the semester. But it is my goal. It's like when you try to work a magic word into every conversation, every single lecture, whether it's photosynthesis or whatever, homeostasis, I try to use the word evolution. I try to reference it, you know, this was a landmark evolutionary step, or the amniotic egg was a landmark evolutionary step in animal evolution, or let's talk about these coevolution between predator and prey. And so by the time we get to the nuts and bolts of it, without me ever teaching evolution, they've heard that it is the basis of all the science that we're going to be talking about.
A quick point of clarity, and I think I know the answer, but for our viewers' sake, the pushback that you've gotten in the past from students that are trying to cling to something, or pretty much any of the anti-evolutionary pushback you've gotten, is that solely from people of faith?
Yes, 100%. 100%. The first time it happened, the first semester it happened, I have them. It happened in the context of when they leave class, I give them a short response they have to write for me. And so it's usually just one or two sentences and they're out the door. These particular students, one specifically, had covered front and back of her card with scripture. Scripture references, writing out the scripture to prove me wrong. And so it's always, you know, I don't believe you, I believe God. I'm going to answer the way you want me to answer, but I don't believe it, I believe God.
Are they surprised to find out that you yourself are a person of faith?
You know, I have been much more intentional since that happened because I, you know, always try to walk a little bit of fine line being in a state university, a large secular state university. And I've always made the point that evolution says nothing about God or faith or any worldview for that matter. But over the last few years, since that first and second semester, there were two semesters where I had substantial pushback, I've tried to be more intentional to say evolution says nothing about faith. I am a person of deep religious faith, and I do not have a problem with evolution. So I usually make that comment. But what I don't go into is my, you know, rationale about, now you can read the Bible this way, and, you know, Genesis is not a historical genre. I don't go into any of that. But I do, you know, present myself as someone of a person of faith. And then I tell them that there are people on both ends of the spectrums, like the Hams and the Dawkins, that will tell you that you can't be a person of faith and accept evolution. And I will just say, I'm an example of why that is not true, you know, that kind of thing. So I try to be intentional about making it as far as I feel that I can go in a state university classroom.
Sure.
Well, I've seen a lot of curriculum that is supposed to inoculate young students going to the university, because the university is that big bad place. It was probably somewhere right in Pilgrim's Progress, in the missing chapter of Pilgrim's Progress,
yeah,
where people lose right their faith. And so I just thought it might be interesting if they're all inoculated against kind of the professor and God's not dead to find you instead. I think that might be a shock to their system in a good way.
I actually have a friend who is a biology professor at a Christian university, and he said that he has a far easier time of convincing his students the truth of evolution than do his colleagues at a state university, simply because Christian students attending a state university have already been, as you said, inoculated. They have a big wall thrown up, so they walk into their biology class already not trusting anything that biology professor is going to say regarding evolution. But he said, my students at a Christian university, their guard is down, and they trust me. And so he said, I have a far easier opportunity. You wouldn't think so, but a far easier opportunity. Now, do all the alumni like that? Probably not, you know, and all the parents. But he said, we are not a Bible college. We are a Christian university. We are a research university, and we're going to teach science. And so I'm like, you go. Yeah. But, you know, interesting, there are two research studies that I just read recently. One was done by professors in higher ed across the board. It was a large number of subjects in the study. But what they were doing is they looked at many different secular universities and students, both majors and non-majors, in biology programs. And among other things that they polled them on, they asked these biology students what they thought about evolution and biology and several different questions. Well, right at 50% of religious students, self-identified religious students, believed that evolution requires atheism, which at 50%, that's probably not a big surprise from religious students. But what did surprise me was that just a couple points lower, non-religious students also said that evolution requires atheism. And so all I could think was, we've done such a good job painting evolution as atheistic that even non-religious students think that evolution requires atheism.
And at such a high cost, yeah. Right? Because as soon as you see the evidence, how do you not believe what is so clearly supported by evidence? It's really...
Well, and I think you make a point in your book that the extremes of this conversation are Ken Ham and Richard Dawkins, and they're both saying that if you believe in evolution, you can't have evolution
in faith. Right. Right.
Right. So you must have had a good response to your book, Baby Dinosaurs in the Ark, in order to come out with a study guide. What led you to writing the study guide? Tell us a little about it, and like, what's the format, and how do you envision it being used?
Well, I wrote the study guide probably because I like to explain, I like to talk. My PhD is in curriculum and instruction. So at my very heart, I'm a science educator, I'm a science communicator, and I want people to understand. And my goal in writing the original book, as well as the study guide, was to target the non-scientist, or at least the person who hasn't studied evolutionary biology, evolutionary science in depth. And so I wanted the study guide just to be a tool to get started. You know, many people won't, if they've been raised, like I said, if they've been raised to think that evolution is by default atheistic, to even approach the topic seems like a betrayal of God. That you're taking a walk on the dark side if you go to the library and check out a book or look it up on the internet. And so I wanted to have the study guide to be, you know, to get your feet in the water. Here's the book. Now here's some things to think about as you're reading along. Because, you know, and then on the other hand, evolutionary biology can get complicated pretty fast. Even for scientists, you know, with modern genetics being so important in understanding evolution, modern cell biology. And so it doesn't take long before, if you dig in very deep at all, you can get into pretty deep waters for a non-scientist. So I wrote the study guide to have, you know, a format of a quick summary of the chapter, and then some discussion prompts. And in these discussion prompts, I wanted to approach different levels of learning. And my pre-K through my university teaching colleagues out there are going to recognize the term Bloom's taxonomy. And so I always had Bloom's taxonomy in my mind as I'm going back through my chapters, and I'm trying to hit different levels of thinking, from just knowledge recall to actually having people process and come up with other examples, or to come up with questions to bring them to a deeper level of understanding and learning with the original book. So the format was intended to dig a little deeper, not only into the content of the book, but into thinking about the book. And so with the questions there, the discussion prompts there, discussion prompts are more prompts than questions. My hope is that a reader for which this is new will not feel so reticent about asking their own questions, and they won't feel like they're betraying God by studying evolution, that it's almost a come along beside me, you know, someone else who is a Christian, who is a believer, and let's ask the hard questions. And here are some hard questions to get you started with, some hard prompts. Now, you know, what do you have more questions about? So I also went part into the study guide. There is a section called Going Deeper, Digging Deeper, where I take the topics of each of the chapters in Baby Dinosaurs, the original Baby Dinosaurs, and then I just talk about something else. You know, there's always more to say. There's always more stories to tell, and I love a good science story. I love a good science history story, the history behind the discovery or how we knew something. And so the study guide has discussion prompts that are geared to hitting on different levels of understanding, different levels of thinking, and then it has sections of digging deeper into some of the topics. And then every chapter in the study guide ends up with a short list of resources, a lot of videos, a lot of even online activities, just for some more learning.
Yeah, I love how those extra resources span a range of ages and interests and mm-hmm. knowledge, too, because you have some stuff that's for kids. You have, different kind of articles and videos and multimedia type of stuff, games even. I thought some of the games mm-hmm. looked fun. And I love
digging deeper.
Yeah.
Honestly, some of my favorite resources are meant for children. I think if they are written in an intelligent way, not dumbed down, which I don't like dumbed down children's books anyway, but if they are written in respect of a child, I think an adult can get just as much out of it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I totally agree on that. My background's aerospace engineering. I didn't need a whole lot of biology as part of my education. And when I was starting to ask these questions about evolution, I just was kind of overwhelmed. Where do I even start? How do I find mm-hmm. a way to learn about this? Where do I, is there a book at the library called Evolution for Dummies? I mean, maybe there is, but, at the time I started asking questions, there wasn't as much developed on the internet, that was useful. And even just Googling something, you get everything. You get Fringe, you get Crazy, you get Academic, you get way too in depth. It was mm-hmm. really hard to know even where to start. So I love.
I was just going to say part of the, I know one of your great interests, Christine, has been the homeschool movement and having curriculum right. from homeschool movements. I think the study guide would be wonderful for that. And when I was a pastor in Chicago, I used to have an evangelism apologetics class called CrossFit, where we talk about some of these issues and I try and introduce some of these issues. And what I noticed is a lot of times, even though it wasn't a big class, it would generate some pretty good heat. In other words, mm-hmm. people were emotionally attached to what they'd grown up with, and they'd mm-hmm. see new ideas mm-hmm. or ideas that they were told were contrary to God and his word as enemies, as the darts of Satan even. So mm-hmm. Christine mentioned when she was intrigued with evolution, she wanted to know where she could learn more about it. How many people are we talking about in this world? You said 100% of the pushback against your teaching of evolution was faith-based. How much do we have to unlearn to be able to come to the table and listen to what you're delivering in Baby Dinosaurs without getting angry about it? In other words, is it more an intellectual journey, or do we have to unpack some volitional and emotional doubt to be able to receive this?
Wow. There's so much that we have about 2 hours on that one. There's where to start? Well, first of all, I would just say as a big picture, I would say that the vast majority, I would say, of people who are religious and who reject evolution for religious reasons, what these people know about evolution comes from anti-evolution resources. They've never studied evolution from the point of someone who accepts the science of evolution. And so someone can feel very, very knowledgeable and has read copious amounts of books and literature and gone to lectures and conferences and rafting trips through the Grand Canyon, creationist rafting trips. And so they have a lot of information about evolution, but all of their information comes from anti-evolution resources. And so that's a big challenge, because not only are you breaking down a deeply held religious belief, you are disqualifying the resources that they have taken as science. They've taken to be truthful science. And then the second thing that I see as a challenge to accomplishing what you said. Well, there was another study that I recently read, but this one was about high school biology teachers. And, you know, a scary stat is that 13% in the survey admit to overtly teaching creationism in the public school. But the scarier part was that 60% of high school, public school now, biology teachers neither strongly support evolution nor strongly support creationism. But this is what that looks like in the classroom. This looks like teaching the bare bones of evolution, maybe just teaching it at the macromolecule level, or teaching it evolution regarding plants, but skipping the whole human evolution part of it. But in my opinion, the worst fallout of this hesitant 60% of teachers who just won't make a stand one way or the other is that's where you get things like, here's evolution. You don't have to believe it. You just have to know it for the test. Just learn it for the test. You don't have to believe it. Just learn it for the test. So what we've got here is a generations of students who have been told that science is something you believe. That science isn't evidence-based, it's values and beliefs-based. And so we have people that have come through our education systems thinking that, well, your facts are just as good as my facts. And you have your science and I have my science. And so I see the challenge there is not just in presenting actual evidence to people. You've got barriers to break down, barriers in knowledge of people who've taught them, but they've been taught from an anti-evolution stance. They've been taught what the facts of evolution are from an anti-evolution standpoint, or they've been taught in their public schools that science is a matter of opinion and science is a matter of values. And so here it is, believe it, don't believe it, doesn't matter, just spit it back out on the test. And so, you know, I'm not sure that we're going to come up with an easy solution, but oh my goodness, that's my goal. Those are my people. Those are my people that I want to talk to, that I want to say, you know, you're not taking a walk on the dark side. You're not turning your back on God. Where did you learn? You know, I'd say, where did you learn about evolution? Who were some of the people you listened to? What are some of the books that you read? And, you know, try to find, you know, the way to say, well, you realize these are all from anti-evolution sources or pro-intelligent design sources. And so there's a lot of things you have to break down there. It's not just about the evidence. It's about, mm-hmm. in some ways, their very, you know, impressions of themselves and what they know and who they've learned from and who they respect. And they feel like they know evolution.
Yeah, oftentimes, probably most of the time, these anti-evolution resources are about as accurate as describing actual evolution as flat Earth resources are at describing the shape of the Earth. Mm-hmm. They're just so far off. They're like, well, actually, what you're saying, what your source's evolution is something that evolution says it isn't, that it can't be.
Yeah.
You can't have a crocoduck. Yeah. You can't have one animal just poof, making a different species of animal that already exists.
A few months ago, I think it was right before Christmas, it was the end of November, I went to a local young earth creationist organization headquartered here in Dallas, where I am, and they were debuting a brand new human evolution movie. And this place is just got all the bells and whistles. They apparently got a lot of money. And I'd never visited there. I'd read a lot about it, seen a lot of pictures. So I decided I would reserve myself a ticket. And I wanted to know from one of the biggest voices for young earth creationism, I wanted to know from their own mouths what their evidence was. And I really did go, honestly. I had my notes ready to take. I had my notes ready to see what's the newest, latest defense of young earth creationism. And it's not an exaggeration to say I was glad I sat on the back row and went by myself so I didn't embarrass anyone. But, you know, the entire time I was like, no, nobody says that. They were denouncing arguments that no one is making. And that's what, and then I looked across that room full of families and children. And they are taking that as scientific evidence, when in reality, nobody is saying the things that they are claiming evolutionists say. And right. So, you know, I was a bit disappointed. I thought there might be something I didn't know, you know.
Yeah. So when I, like I said, I didn't have a strong biology background. I have read an awful lot since then. But that was one of the things that really struck me when I was reading and learning, and I was looking at everything because I didn't know. I didn't have the ability or the vocabulary to discern the different sources or to know it. I just didn't know, right? And that was a common thing I saw from anti-evolution literature or resources, or especially like old earth creationist arguments for special creation or against evolution. And it was like, that's not what I'm seeing. That those are the same kind of arguments flat earthers make against the shape of the earth, or young earthers make against the age of the earth. They're not actually real arguments, and they're not actually evidence-based. Like the evidence, that's not what the evidence says. So if that's the best that you have, wow, I mean, that's nothing. There's nothing to support that.
But you know, unfortunately, this is all presented with lots of scientific trappings, lots of scientific language, lots of scientific trappings, and with a lot of authority, lots of letters behind your names. I mean, the people that presented at this film screening all had higher education, you know, behind some of the most adamant young earth creationists I know are medical doctors, very good medical doctors, very intelligent medical doctors. I can think of three off the top of my head.
Engineers too, young earth creationists. And engineers, where it's more of an application-based science rather than a pure, I guess,
a theoretical-based,
quickly check in with our YouTube audience and a live viewer comment from Dr. Clark Van Gilder, who says the key to mental development is the ability to challenge one's own understanding. The culture of Christianity has evolved to be opposed to that kind of thinking and therefore set against evidence. It's been described, creationism has been described as poor theology fortified by an army, a pseudoscience army of straw men, which seems to be what you ladies are saying. I guess the question would be, from our viewers who have deconstructed or deconverted and left the faith because of this desert of trust. When you lose somebody's trust, it's really hard to get them back. I know if you're starting a new restaurant, getting somebody into your restaurant is a lot easier than somebody who's left your restaurant already because of poor service, poor food, high prices. Mm-hmm. So with the Christians who have walked out and they're listening to us talk right now about how so much of Christianity, especially modern apologetics, is built on this foundation of an anti-science mindset. How do you hope to earn a hearing back? I mean, I know that this book is seeking to kind of do that, right? But how do you answer somebody who says, well, if I can't trust them, if they don't even recognize something the whole world has recognized for the last 200 years, why would I believe them about the rest of this stuff?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that you've hit on a very crucial problem. There is if we deny, as people of faith, if we deny empirical, observable evidence, how are we to be believed on issues that require faith, like a resurrection or an incarnation? And that's actually a discussion that I have when I do introduce evolution to my students at the university. I tell them there are lots of things that I believe. I believe my family loves me. I believe in love and beauty. And I talk about things that I believe. And then I tell them that actually the most important things in my life are things that I believe. But I don't believe science. I accept science evidence. But that doesn't mean my beliefs are unimportant. And I think that we've allowed that other end of the spectrum that says evolution requires atheism. I think we've allowed them to define our terms and to say that if it's not science, it's therefore not important. And so I try to paint to my students, and hopefully it comes across in my writing, that the most important things in my life are things that cannot be proven by science or cannot be demonstrated by science. The most important things in my life are things that I believe. And I think that when we've made an unfortunate, you know, dichotomy that it's got to be all of one or all of the other. And we've also, you know, made that dichotomy of, you know, if you have a natural explanation for something, it's by default demeaning. So people of faith, you're struggling with this, don't want a natural explanation. They want to be able to say it's God and only God. People who are deconstructing or questioning, you know, just like you said, John, you know, why should I believe you on this faith stuff if you're rejecting everything I can see with my own eyes? It's a real problem. It is a true problem. And I think that, you know, we've talked about this before. It used to be that we thought that evolution would lead to atheism and evolution would lead to rejecting faith. But in my experience, it's been the opposite. Like, you know, the student that I told you, it was raised as an atheist. You know, he had a huge sigh of relief that he could accept his religious faith because he was just right there on the edge. You know, I know the science is true, but I'm in this new faith community that's telling me I have to reject it. And he just, you could tell he was just really tormented by the thought of giving up one or the other. And unfortunately, most people will give up the thing that relies on belief and not what relies on the evidence. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Following up with another YouTube comment from JS, have you contributed to BioLogos? Have they contacted you about the book, giving positive feedback?
The foreword is by Deb Harsma.
Oh. Okay, sorry about that.
The forward is by the president of BioLogos, Deb Harsma. Yes. She wrote a beautiful foreword to Baby Dinosaurs, the original book.
Hmm. So this might be kind of a follow-up on that question. How do you recommend, let's say I'm not, but let's say I'm an attendee at a church with small groups, and I wanted to present your book in our small group. Is there any advice you'd give to somebody bringing this to the leaders, the elders, the pastors, whoever's in charge of the homeschool co-op or whatever, to present this in a way? And what has your experience been in that way? Have people been accepting of it, or are treating it like kind of like an electrified rail?
I tell you, the experience that I've had with this book, and this happened two different times at my church, where nothing was public, nothing was brought up. Oh, should we study this book? But on two different occasions, I had people that I had never met before reach out to me and almost in a whisper, you know, after church, say, I heard you wrote a book. Heard you wrote this book. And in both instances, both of them had teenage sons that were struggling, with fitting in the youth group, because not because of anything that was said, because to the contrary, both of the boys, because I asked them, when you're in youth group, what kind of pushback or feedback do you get when you stand up for science, so to speak? And to the one, both of them said, oh, we don't bring it up. We don't bring it up. So they were both just feeling very, very isolated within their youth group, with their youth pastor, with their youth group volunteers. And so in both of those cases, we had great dinners, lunches with the boys and their family. And how I approached, and the very first time I had this happen, I will tell you, I was a little bit, I was a lot bit scared, a lot bit nervous, because I had only met the father of this young man just in the context of, hey, let's go for coffee. He would like to ask you some questions. I knew the dad was, I had the impression the dad was supporting his son, but I didn't know that overtly. So the young man would ask me questions, and I remember thinking, oh my goodness, is the dad going to like my answer? Or is he going to say, well, we're done here, and collect his son and promptly leave? But it didn't. It didn't happen. And I said some pretty straightforward things, like, you know, when one of the young men would say, so you don't believe that everything in Genesis is literal, or you don't believe it actually happened exactly that way. And I just said, no, I don't. And this is why, and this is another way to read it. And both conversations were lovely, but with both sets of parents, both young men. And so I don't know that the church where I go to right now is ready for that in any kind of public way, because both of these young men felt very isolated. They felt like they were each other's only friends in youth group, or at least the only friends that they could talk to about how they really felt about these things. But how I would approach it, if someone wanted to approach their church, their homeschool, I think one of the biggest misconceptions about evolutionary biology is the idea that a natural explanation is somehow demeaning, that it somehow makes creation less than if we can describe a natural process that brought the things we see into the way we see it now, into the variety and the diversity that we see on our planet. And so, you know, I say, no one finds the water cycle demeaning. We can explain the mechanisms behind the science of the water cycle, yet we still pray to God in times of a drought, or we thank God for rain. Even closer to home, parents will pray for a child, the gift of a child, to come into their home, either by birth or by adoption. People will pray for a child. And when the child comes into the home, everybody is thanking God. Some may even call it a miracle, thanking God for the miracle of the birth of this child or the this child being adopted into this family. But nobody is going to argue about the 9-month biological, embryological process that brought that child into being. No one thinks that if we explain the biology behind embryologic development, no one thinks that we are denigrating that child or that that child is no less made in the image of God. But we have somehow incorporated or internalized this message that a natural explanation demeans God, demeans the person, demeans the creation. So I would probably, you know, start out with that God is given the thanks, as the wisdom and the sustainer of creation. The science just tells us how it naturally came about, and that's not demeaning at all.
So, kind of along those lines, I often see people argue from an intelligent design movement perspective, where mm-hmm. where maybe they're not saying so much that it's demeaning God, but they're saying their message more is, well, it's this natural process is too complex, and it involves all this complexity and all this information. So it can't have been natural, and this is evidence that God is the designer, God is the creator. It's a little bit of a different argument than maybe the kind of a young earth creationist poof magical kind of creation. Mm-hmm. It's more of a God's tinkering with it because it couldn't have happened randomly or by itself. Talk about some of the problems with this approach and why it doesn't really stack up with the evidence as well.
Well, the first thing I would say is when we give God as the answer to something we don't understand, what happens to God when we gain more evidence, when we gain more knowledge? You know, the intelligent design creationist movement quite often would cite the human blood clotting cascade as being one of those processes that you mentioned that are just too complex to have evolved. And so God had to have micromanaged the human blood clotting cascade because it never could have happened randomly. And then lo and behold, we found other mammalian blood clotting cascades that were missing bits and pieces and still clotted just fine. And even other organisms that were closely related to mammals in the big animal family tree that were also missing parts of the clotting cascade and still their blood clotted just fine. And so what that told us was blood clotting cascade evolved and can function without all of the parts and pieces in place. And so what we've done is we've painted ourselves into a corner that said, oh, this process is so complex, it could have never have come about just randomly. But science marches on, science doesn't stop, science keeps collecting evidence. And then when we do explain it, where is our place for God? I mean, that's one big problem that I see, is if we make God the answer to all the questions we don't know, like, you know, back in Newton's day, even though all of the work he did with gravity, he still thought the planets were pushed around the sun by angels because he couldn't explain planetary movement. And then lo and behold, we found out why planets orbit the sun. And so we didn't have a job for the angels to push the planets around any longer. So that's a very primitive example. But with the blood clotting cascade, with the bacterial flagella, things that were at one point said to be irreducibly complex or could not have evolved because they're too, every step had to be in place at once, we find out that wasn't so. And so, you know, the whole thing just falls to the ground at that point. But I think maybe a more serious problem with making God a micromanager of creation is that if we assign credit to God for wonderful designs in, for example, the human body, to who do we attribute credit for things that are bad designs? And in probably my favorite of the digging deeper sections in the Baby Dinosaur Study Guide, I go into one of these cases, and the historical background of the scientist that first was studying blood groups, and in his study of blood groups, he came upon a discovery of a connection between malaria endemic areas and the large populations of the Anopheles mosquito that carries the malaria parasite. And so he is credited with the discovery that a person who carries one mutated gene for the hemoglobin is resistant to malaria, but they are they do not have sickle cell disease. Whereas if a person has both mutated versions of the hemoglobin gene, they will be very, very seriously ill with sickle cell disease. But in the heterozygous condition, where a person has one functioning hemoglobin gene, one non-functioning, they still make enough functioning hemoglobin to not have sickle cell, but they are resistant to malaria. So I try to make the point in the study guide that, oh, what a wonderful design. God has designed this genetic situation where with just one of these genes, this person isn't sick with sickle cell, and the person lives in this malaria endemic region, but they are resistant to malaria. What a wonderful design. Isn't that a wonderful thing to credit a designer with? But then I point out in this digging deeper section of the study guide that when you have a gene that provides an advantage like that one gene does, it is going to stay in a population. And if you have an isolated population, before long, you're going to have individuals come together and have children that each carry one of those mutated genes. They're not sick with sickle cell. They are resistant to malaria. But because they are both carriers, they have a 25% chance of having a child with sickle cell disease. And that's why we see certain populations of the world where sickle cell disease is very prevalent. So the same design, so to speak, that provides a protection in one case, because that design is there, is tragic for a whole other part of the population. It causes a debilitating, often fatal disease in the same population. So if we are going to credit God with a micromanaging this wonderful anti-malarial design, we have to have at the same time credit God with this devastating, debilitating disease that comes about because that gene is in the population. And two people that are carrying that gene have a much greater chance, probability of having a child with it. And then you talk about all the genetics that we know about viral infections that are in our genome, that we carry all of these basically fossil genes that that testify to a very long history. You have to talk about a micromanaging designer who purposefully put these genes in our genome for no reason whatsoever, even though it looks exactly like we evolved from common ancestry. So that's the problem I see with demanding a micromanaging designer as opposed to a God who allowed life through a natural process. And the natural process is you're going to have things like we see with the malaria sickle cell thing.
I think we might just have enough time to wrap up a few of the comments and a last question from YouTube, and then maybe a last question from each of us, Christine. Carmel Crunk says we need to get out of our echo chambers, a bit of advice. Dr. Van Gilder says, what an interesting thought experiment to consider why we perceive scientific threats to our theology. We'll accept science when it agrees with our own understanding, but not when it challenges it. And I want to leave you with this question, Janet, from JS again, who says, why do so many popular apologists like Frank Turek, Sean McDowell, J. Warner Wallace, Greg Kuchel, etc., still oppose evolution, even though it seems like settled matter in academia? Wonderful question, JS.
I think you touched on this earlier in an earlier question when you asked, were the students who pushed back against evolution, were they all religious? And I think that is a question that we've got to ask ourselves. Why do we not find any young earth non-religious people? If there truly is evidence for a young earth, surely there would be someone who is non-religious who would be, you know, promoting a young earth. The same thing with a special creation. We just don't find any non-religious people who are supporting any kind of instantaneous creation or any kind of micromanaged creation. To a person, anyone who proposes either a young earth or a special creation are religious people. And if there truly was evidence for such, you would think that somewhere on the planet there would be a non-religious person accepting that or touting that or promoting those ideas, but you just don't see it. So I think we have to conclude that creationism is accepted for religious reasons and not for science reasons. There is a one of the scientists associated with Answers in Genesis. She was in an interview one time and she said, I don't accept creationism because of the evidence, or I don't base what I believe on the evidence. That's what she said. I don't base what I believe on evidence. I base what I believe on my faith and the Bible. And so she was upfront about it. And there are a handful of other young earth creationists who will be intellectually honest enough to say, I reject evolution for religious reasons, not for scientific reasons. Todd Wood is one of them. He'll say that evolution is not a theory in crisis, but I reject it because of my religious beliefs. And so that's the problem, is that with intellectual honesty, evolution is not rejected because of the science evidence. Evolution is rejected because of religious and faith beliefs.
I'm going to give Christine the last word, so I'll take this one. You mentioned that we don't push back against like the water cycle or gravity or other things like that. But one of the objections that I often see about evolution particularly is the treatment of death. The treatment of death in the Bible is as a great enemy, the last great enemy. It must be defeated. Death seen in natural selection and the fossil record is more of a neutral agent. What do you say to that comment, that evolution doesn't seem to be compatible with the Bible or the Christian or Christian theology, because death doesn't appear as an enemy there.
Are you saying it, like, death is just part of nature? It's part of, yeah. Well, you know, again, you've got where you're having a theological discussion and you're having a scientific discussion. And that's what I was trying to maybe express with the idea that a natural process isn't necessarily a demeaning process, or it's not a demeaning process at all. And so, you know, I think I would say that death is a natural process. Death is a given. Death, you know, nature is red and tooth and claw. And death is part of what we see in the natural world. But my faith redeems those things that are, that we see as bad and evil in the natural world. To nature, death just is. It's just, it's part of the life cycle. But can my faith then redeem that? I might say in the same way, science tells me that I am descended from common ancestry, that I share ancestry with the entire animal kingdom, including some of my instincts to put myself above my other humans in a world where the winner takes all, so to speak, in a natural environment. But to that I would say, but my faith redeems that. My faith tells me that as a image bearer of God, I need to rise above my animal instincts, so to speak, to put myself first and to defeat all around me. And so I just really would like to say, we've got to get away from this one or the other thing. We can accept the natural process, in this case, death, as occurring, and death as a part of the whole life processes. But as a person of faith, how do we redeem the sadness that comes with that? How do we redeem the finality that it seems like when we're faced with the death? That's a question for our faith. That's not a question for science. Science just tells us it's a part of life. Death is a part of life. But my faith tells me this can be redeemed. And how can it be redeemed? Well, Jesus Christ, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's really good. And you have another book in the works, right? And it seems like that might be a topic from your, is that something that you talk about in your next book? Tell us about your book. What's the title?
A lot of the things, yeah. Yes, I have a new book that is releasing this fall. There it is on the screen, The God of Monkey Science, People of Faith in a Modern Scientific World. And what I do in this new book is I start with the premise that that evolution explains everything that we know in biology. It is not a defense of evolution. I point people toward the first book for that. But what this book looks at is how Christian rejection of evolution and decades of fighting against evolution has hamstrung people of faith when it comes to looking at other areas of science, climate science, science of the pandemic, science of DNA and modern genetics and things like this. We've basically taken the same arguments that we have thrown against evolution for decades, and we've reworded them, retooled them, and we've thrown those exact arguments that we've used against science and scientists in our fight against evolution. We use those same arguments in denying climate science, in denying science within the pandemic, and in other areas of modern science. It was a fascinating research for me to see how there was a playbook, so to speak, a game plan that we have learned to distrust science in certain ways. And we just take that model of distrusting science that we learned in a fight against evolution. We take that same model and we don't trust scientists in a pandemic. We think that the things that we're being forced to do in a pandemic are showing that we have no faith in God. And so the pandemic becomes atheistic. Believing in the science of in a pandemic makes you trust God less or makes you more atheistic, just like we have done with evolution and climate science the same way. So it's basically how the fight against evolution has changed the way we even talk about science, and how we approach science, how we talk about science, how we analyze science has all been colored, has been structured from the fight against evolution.
That sounds really interesting. I'm looking forward to reading it.
Thank you. It'll be out in this fall.
And we have to schedule you to be on when that comes out.
Yeah.
Very
thank you.
Much looking
forward
I'll
be happy
to. Yeah. Well,
save my
thank
square.
You again. Janet, you're a ray of sunshine. You really are a wonderful voice in the wilderness when it comes to this topic and others. And we're just grateful to have you today.
Thanks, guys. I love being on your show. It's wonderful.
Well, thank you. It was a wonderful conversation and appreciate hearing from you. It was so funny because I was just going to ask the same question about apologists that our YouTube viewer asked. So I'm glad
it is frustrating. That is a frustrating reality.
I had a conversation just this past week with someone who had been reading about the resurrection and asking questions about is the evidence for that, for Jesus' resurrection sufficient or reasonable. And she thought these arguments were compelling until she got to a chapter where the authors were talking about intelligent design and pushing intelligent design type arguments. And as soon as she got there, she was like, I don't know if I can trust anything in this book anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Exactly. Just broke the trust. Our
whole apologetics complex really needs to go back to the fundamental understanding that apologetics is for us to share the hope that is within us. And that is the hope in Jesus Christ, not in the Kalam cosmological argument. It's getting back to what C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien referred to as the story that every man wants to believe is true. And I think if we take a page out of their books, we'd be in much better position. But again, thank you for joining us, folks. And we'll be back with you shortly. Thanks.